This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 268, Seeing Reality. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here with my two favorite podcasters and friends, Michael Martin and Andy Piper at GamesAtWork.biz. How's it going, guys?
Fabu.
I am well. I've had the UK is lucky to have a day off today and on Monday as well. So I've got a nice beginning of a nice long weekend in fabulous isolation. in which I intend to build as many bits of electronics and Lego that have been sitting around my house as side projects.
Is isolation next to Chichester?
Then it's near Ipswich.
Well, in my case, it's kind of somewhat on the west side of London. But, okay.
I just love the name of that town.
We're sheltering at home, so
yeah. Yeah, I've not updated my profile pics to show the at home stuff, but I suppose that's the right thing to do these days. You know, where can you find me? At home.
127.0.0.1.
Are we changing it to gamesatwork.home then?
Yeah, but somebody's already bought that URL as soon as you mentioned it.
Maybe so only popular. If we play it on my home pod. Yes. All right.
Well, remarkable.
Let's get right into the show. And speaking of Apple, we're starting right with that. We've got a couple of intriguing updates on what Apple and some other companies are doing here recently. And one of the first ones is dealing with face shields and producing face shields, design those face shields. I've actually taken a look at some of the design pieces for them, and that's pretty cool from a visual there as well. And sourcing masks as well, 20 million masks and getting them around to places that need them for personal protective gear. So thoughts on this, guys? Lots of companies are doing these sort of things, and it's great to see companies jumping on it, making it happen.
Well, I think the fact that, you know, they're leveraging 3D printing, not Apple specifically, but other companies that are listed in this article on TechCrunch. I think the democratization of some of that technology has obviously been a boon. I know that where I am on our next door group and some of the Facebook groups I'm part of, people are talking about, you know, using their 3D printers to print stuff for the local hospitals. The fact that Apple's shared designs that they've come up with, the fact that Apple's made that big investment, obviously is hugely appreciated, I'm sure, by the healthcare community, and it's so important. So those are my thoughts, really.
Levels of creativity around this are huge. I remember seeing an example of someone taking a 2-liter bottle and showing where to cut and how to cut it to make an improvised face shield from a 2-liter bottle. I know that some of the university maker labs around here in North Carolina, from the University of North Carolina and Duke Systems, are collaborating, doing the same kind of thing. Andy, from a 3D printing perspective, that's happening right now too. Another favorite company of mine, Tilly, the makers of the infamous or famous Tilly hats from Canada, have come up with a face shield that you can hang down from your hat and attach to it, which I thought was pretty dang cool, too. So lots of this going on right now. And aside from the TechCrunch, you know, article about face shields and protective gear, we saw another innovation that was pretty cool about using a combination of LED technology to be able to flash things on a protective mask that you can wear over your face. So think about this as a almost a mobile billboard that you could advertise on. You could instruct people to stay away from you, a whole range of things.
I love this. I mean, obviously, it's like eye-catching and different, it's fun. It's customizable. The idea that it's using it as a kind of a warning for people to keep away, then that's also quite interesting. I don't know how many people are not paying attention to the rules and the guidance that we've been issued, but I do love the fact that these masks are being promoted by through Gizmodo and Laughing Squid. I think it's really fun, and as we've spoken about this at length on both our previous show and this one, predecessor show, I should say, and this one, you know, the fact that you're able to build some of this technology into wearable devices or just clothing is wonderful.
So as long as we're on the subject of, you know, what other companies are doing, I saw an article like this too, Michael, but I think this one came from you about what Tesla's doing about taking various car parts, repurposing them and building ventilators from them. What did you take away from this?
Well, the thing that I enjoy about really much all of these stories is the innovation here is, you know, Henry Ford, right? What I mean by that is these factories were not designed to build ventilators. But because of the manufacturing process, once you retool, it's pretty efficient to then start pumping out many, many devices from a factory line. And so I just find all these stories interesting from that perspective. And, you know, in this case, they're really talking about using a sub-assembly system and using components from their infotainment system in order to drive the ventilator. But I just find it interesting how quickly I mean, just think how long it takes to initially build out a plant like this, right? How many years it probably was to build out the plant that built these Model 3s. And within literally a couple of weeks, they're able to turn it into the generation of a totally different product.
Right.
That's the thing that I am just utterly amazed by.
Yeah, what I really like is the repurposing of parts. Like we saw the example of using seat vents, you know, or seat fans, you know, in one example. And here Tesla is using the infotainment system as the controlling brains behind the environment. So super clever. And the fact is, for such medical devices, typically we're talking about years planning.
Well, yeah, I mean, testing, when you talk about that, I mean, it's a whole compliance issue with the medical devices, right? So that's a totally different thing. It takes years to get through the design process. But once you have it there, then standing up manufacturing is quick. So.
Yep. So let's now pivot from some things that are very much real and tangible to some things that are much more virtual. And we talked about this a little bit in the pre-show that we've experienced CG type humans in a couple of different perspectives. And Michael, you've probably had more exposure to this than most of us in a variety of things.
Yeah, this is really funny because I've played around a lot with iClone, and I actually saw this from James Martin, who works with iClone and also is a professor at Georgia State University working on digital video production and CGI, et cetera. And, you know, I've been CGI'd before too, which was really kind of fun. But what's so amazing is not only has the rendering gotten so much better and the fact that it's so much faster that it's basically real time, but the ability, and we've seen this for some time, of actors to be replicated into films or in using, you know, gaming technology like Unreal. And it's amazing, not just in the sense of bringing back your favorite old actors, right? Or you know, Princess Leia coming back in the recent Star Wars movies as the young Princess Leia, right? But the ability to just create experiences of people, not for people, that they could never actually do at a fidelity, at a cost, and a speed that is, you know, constantly getting better, faster, cheaper, right? And it's so amazing, and I every time I see an article, again, it's another one of these, every time I see an article like this, it reminds me of how fast innovation is actually going compared to, you know, 30 years ago or 20 years ago. It's like every couple of years, it just seems to get faster and faster, better and better, cheaper and cheaper. And it's a shout out really to James and John from iClone, the Martin brothers, on just how cool the work that they are doing also is driving some of this same stuff.
I think the cool thing for me about this particular article that that we'll share in the show notes from VFX Voice is the real-time aspect, right? Mm-hmm. So we've seen for some time, both through movies and good examples you've just listed, obviously video games, increasingly amazing visuals and cutscenes, which are typically, you know, mocap driven. But they are post-rendered, and they, you know, and emotions and so on can be added afterwards. And you know, the concept that we're getting to the point where we can really drive these things. Once you've got them up, the model, you can start to drive, you know, real-time voice through them and have the models respond without mocap, without any kind of additional like stuff laid over. It's just phenomenal. It's wonderful. I think that's, for me, that's the real takeaway from this, is really understanding the number of systems and the number of algorithms that need to go into this. But we're starting to see it come to a place where we can start to do some really interesting things.
Well, the real, and I keep saying iClone, I should say Realusion, right? What they did 10, 12 years ago with iClone would allow you to put emotion on a simple, I'll call it simple emotion, and you could take your face and skin it onto a body and do it in real time then. But now, I mean, the acceleration, the ability to use AI-based generation to drive what they can show with emotion and part of the article gets down into their character creator tool set and how they're doing this. And you know, not only analyze a picture and turn it into a three-dimensional face at a much, much better fidelity than what was available 12 years ago, but to then add those emotions based off of, you know, the dialogue that you're pumping through, right, or the scene. Again, as close as possible to real time. And that's where we get just amazing capabilities.
And without needing compute power the size of a refrigerator too, right? You know, it's...
No, you could probably do it just fine on my... Well, I have version 4 of iClone still on my Windows machine because it's an old machine. I don't think it will run the new stuff. But that machine hasn't been updated in...
Yeah, well, and that's not a refrigerator sized machine either, right?
No,
you know, the point here too is that this level of AI, coupled with the ability to render, coupled with the ability to do a lot of it from a single picture, you know, is like, wow.
Well, I will say it's not a fridge, but I'm also not going to pick it up and show it on camera here.
Yeah, but don't do that because we're an audio podcast,
right? And I don't want to throw out my back.
So this would be a useful thing for those of you who are doing your social distancing, but would want to have a friend nearby, and you could just create this, you know, super fast.
Yeah.
Nifty. This next article is one that I just read and looked at the first couple of pieces and went absolutely wow. Because we're talking about facial recognition. We're talking about visual AI. And we're talking here specifically about removing things so that you can see beyond. You can see more clearly. I've set it up, Michael, for you. Start walking us through it and let's kind of all get a little wowy about the whole thing.
Given
this is an audio podcast.
Given this is an audio podcast,
And I'll try
visuals in this one.
I'll try to give this at total layman's because I haven't fully read through the detailed papers. But this is really about using machine learning to remove, I'll call it imperfection in pictures. But it's much more than that because, you know, Photoshop's had the ability to use pattern recognition around imperfection to kind of clean that up. And the more natural an environment was, the easier it was. But this is, I'll call it unnatural environments. And what do I mean by that? So what the authors and the researchers of this paper have done is they've used layer reconstruction in order to take, and it's actually, I think they start with a video, not just a picture, to phase out things that overlay. And so as an example, you might have a picture of some object, in this case it's a sign, that's behind a piece of glass, and that piece of glass is having reflections on it. Well, those are really hard to clean up if you're just kind of using the spot cleanup brush in Photoshop, because it's, you know, it's a picture of text, so it's very man-made. And that stuff doesn't clean up as well. And it's changing color, right? Because the color changes based off of the reflection, et cetera. But by shifting, you know, slightly left and right in a video, they're able to get enough information to get rid of the layer that you don't want. And so they get rid of the reflection of the glass that is sitting on top of the sign. The second example is a much more natural one, and this is a chain link fence in front of a natural area with trees and a little path. And again, by shifting slightly left and right and leveraging machine learning, they're able to recognize the pattern of the imperfection layer that you want to get rid of and the pattern of the layer underneath, so that you can replace the two and clean it up in such a way that there was never a chain link fence here. And then the last example that they show is really removing raindrops on a camera lens or on a piece of glass looking out. And it's, to me, that one's not as exciting because it's almost the same thing as the reflection removal. If you think about it, which is, you know, changing imperfections of the light and how it refracts coming through a surface of an image behind it. But this is unbelievably amazing to me because I years ago, I was at a conference and I actually spent a 4-hour work session with Photoshop right when they introduced the ability to remove things with the brush, right? Mm-hmm. You know, to just kind of draw on it and it would get rid of it. And they actually went through in a pretty technical layer on how they got rid of it. And, you know, the key thing was it looks for similar pattern data around it, and then it just replaces it with that data in such a way that if it's a natural thing, you know, something that has fractal patterns, things of that nature, Then it was easily replaced and it was really hard to see through the normal look of the eye. But anytime you had straight lines, man-made things, it was so obvious, it had lots of imperfections. This fixes that problem. This is amazing.
The thing that I love as well, especially about this, I mean, obviously they've shared their research, which is always welcome, but they've also shared the code on GitHub.
Yes. Yep.
420 stars, 47 forks, people still being committed to, I think as of yesterday. It's wonderful. It's as you say, that some of these techniques or the capabilities have been partially available inside tools like Photoshop for a while, but by passing them through machine learning, TensorFlow in particular here, right, we're starting to be able to do some really incredible things, and that is very exciting.
Yeah. I've downloaded both of the detailed papers. I've put them on my Kindle and in my iBooks library, in both of them. So no matter where I'm at, when I get a chance, I can start reading through it in detail.
I mean, I could do the same, but I think it would probably just blow my mind. So I'm going to leave it to the experts and just maybe play with the code sometime later.
I want to do that too. I think I've starred the code. I think I'm watching it. I haven't done a clone yet.
One of the things that we talked about in an earlier podcast was using machine learning to add things. So remember the example of like adding windows or towers or doors, yep, you know, to a building. So the intriguing thing about this is both subtractive and additive, right? So
magic.
Well, yes. So thought experiment for y'all. Can you think of something that might be, let's follow the mathematical principles here. Could there be something that would allow you to multiply as opposed to being additive and subtractive.
Well, I hear a lot of that's going on with people being sequestered at home. A lot of multiplication.
maybe so. I don't know. I mean, there are times when you know, I look out at a crowd of people in a movie, for example, and you can see the same archetype person, and it's like, oh, you know, look, we've got this army of orcs.
Well, just look at what I mean, talk about Weta. I mean, Weta pioneered mm-hmm. that 20 right. years ago with really making that army of orcs unique.
20 right? years ago.
Yeah. Jeez. Actually, it was 22 years ago. Years ago, I think, when they started.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Feels great.
Well, it's an intriguing technology here, and I think you're seeing a little bit where I was heading, where this technology combined with other technologies and so on and so forth can do some really intriguing things.
And they had two technologies and so on and so on. Sorry.
So talking about technologies that we've chatted about here at length on this podcast and even just fairly recently too, a news article about a merger that was ostensibly happening before the whole COVID structure came through. Foursquare, these are the makers of Swarm, are merging with Factual. And I read through this with a lot of interest, because I've been a Foursquare user since the very beginning, really enjoyed the whole mayorship, you know, accumulating coins that never been able to spend on anything. And
really valuable.
Really valuable. And well, there is value here. Foursquare apparently has reported more than $100 million in revenue for last year.
I get more coins from that pinata every Monday. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's super. Well, not recently, I'm sure, Andy.
No, indeed.
So all the check-in data, all these things that are here. This could go into like 12 different directions. But the data is certainly extraordinarily valuable. And as businesses are opening and closing, and we can foresee a lot of that going to happen here in the next, you know, weeks and months ahead, as well as all the social distancing aspects that we have talked about here before, I will be reading into more about what Factual is. And what they do and what they will have access to now that this merger has happened.
I'm glad you said that, because I am racking my brain. And I, like you, I've been using Foursquare since the beginning. I've been using Swarm. I tweeted non-ironically this week that Swarm as a game has become less entertaining because of various lockdowns. But that's not the point. I've used it for life logging. Factual is an 11-year-old company, and I don't remember. Maybe we spoke about it back in the day, and it's one of those things that kind of got lost in the mist of change and history. But evidently, they're also focused on location data, and in their case, improving advertising. It launched as a repository for open data, so I'm surprised that I haven't heard of it. I'm excited. I mean, it. On paper, in this article, it sounds like a natural combination of sets of technology and data. Or, as we all know, personal data privacy and other issues have become increasingly important and front of mind for people over the course of the last sort of 2 years, really, with regulations coming in different jurisdictions. But like you, I'm very curious to see where this goes and what this would do.
I could see, Andy, where there's an opportunity here for monetization. You know, so mm-hmm. say, for example, you know, the two of us who've been around since the beginning, we could say, look, we're willing to let you know about our check-ins or our history in exchange for some discounts, right? Or in exchange for opportunities. It's targeted advertising that we really care about. So that could be an intriguing angle that combines the two together. Could be all done on blockchain, could be revocable, right? So that way we're sharing data that we have allowed to share for a period of time, and then say, nope, don't like to do that anymore. So it could be some things like that could result from this.
And sure. As you know, I was also back on it at the beginning, but I haven't used it for 4 years, so I got nothing to say.
Well, and you deleted everything off, off the account, right, and off the servers. Yeah.
As best as I could.
Yeah, yeah. So this is interesting, and given all of the importance as we're going through this wave of COVID-19 and recognizing that there may well be other waves in the future, and if we are better prepared for other waves in the future to be able to more rapidly identify who are the people that you've come near and around to be able to suppress any further outbreaks quicker. This kind of data, like Andy, you were saying, coupled with the cell phone tower data, coupled with a whole range of other data, could be very, very useful. All righty then. Well, let's switch gears to
something much more useful.
Something more entertaining. Let's just say.
Much more useful.
And Andy, you're the expert in this space because. Well, you grew up somewhere where BBC Micro was a household word, so to speak, or words.
Yeah, so a little known fact to many people is that Arm, who of course is a company that now licenses their chip technologies and has become incredibly valuable through the rise of low power devices and cell phones, grew out of a company called Acorn. A company that started in Cambridge in the UK back in the 80s, or possibly even late 70s. I grew up in that period, and when I was at school, our first computers typically, although my very first computer at school was a Commodore PET, that big hulking metal giant of a thing with a tiny, tiny green screen. The kind of democratization of computers in schools in the UK was through a program that the BBC sponsored to get this company Acorn to build computers. I had an Acorn Electron, which is a kind of low-cost home device. It was kind of a competitor or alternative to the ZX Spectrum, to the Amiga, Commodore Amiga later, to some of those computers that our broader international audience may have heard of. But certainly the BBC computers were dominant in UK schools and homes for most of the 80s and early 90s, probably. Acorn became Acorn Risk Machines and then Advanced Risk Machines, and pivoted into, you know, the chip designs versus the hardware manufacturing. So, so the point of that ramble, was that now the complete BBC Micro games archive, which back in the day I had to load on cassette tape into my computer, or even later floppy disks, but they were the, 5 1/4 or 3.5 inch disks, it's now available to play in the browser in JavaScript. I mean, you both will have heard of Elite, right? Yep. I mean, come on, you cannot not have heard of Elite because Elite came out on all the devices, but Elite started on the BBC Acorn computers, and of course continues today in Elite Dangerous. But, you know, that classic wireframe game, games like Repton, Exile, Thrust, many others that I grew up on and loved in the 80s, you can now play in a browser through this this games archive. It's really remarkable to me, not only that, well, I mean, I think it's wonderful, apart from anything else, that, you know, the companies behind them, most of whom, if not all of whom, have passed, are not kind of like taking action to have this stuff taken down. I mean, in those scenarios, there is very little to be gained other than just, you know, trolling the audience, given that a lot of younger people will immediately gravitate to a newer console. But for me, this is wonderful. It's a true archive. It's a true way of retaining memories. And it was something I grew up on. And I know at least one, I said to Michael and Michael in our pre-show conversation, this is almost designed for an audience of one Mr. E-Predator Hughes, but possibly some other listeners will remember and have fond memories. So the complete BBC Micro games archive, bbcmicro.co.uk, is available, and go waste time on it because it's incredible. It's really fun.
I like Mr. Chuckles because it's basically Donkey Kong.
Chucky Egg.
Well, and Snapper is basically Pac-Man too. Yeah,
Chucky Egg was brilliant.
Chucky Egg used
to have in the original version. It used to have this bug where you played this little guy in a little yellow guy with a hat, and you had to kind of get up to the top of the level past some chickens, to the big chicken in a big cage. But it had this bug in very early versions where if you jumped at exactly the right point on the screen, then you could, like, your hat would attach to the bottom of one of the other platforms, and you could, like, walk along the bottom of the platform with hanging by your hat. Yes. I mean, I'm looking at the top 20 games on this website right now. Elite, I mean, as it says, the classic space trading game, is amazing. Chucky Egg, very, very popular. Repton, I remember. Exile, Thrust, Citadel, Imogen, Codename Droid, Arcadians. I mean, honestly, there are more. I could go through. There are many more. but I could go through this and reminisce for a long time. But as I say, it's available. And the other thing is that the website is open source and on GitHub.
Yep.
The fact that you can run these computers in JavaScript in a web browser now is just, I mean, it shouldn't be mind blowing, because, of course, you know, JavaScript in our browsers are very, very capable things. And these computers, you know, these computers used to run on 32 to 128K of RAM. You know, I mean, these games are easily, you know, less than a small JavaScript script these days, but it's remarkable stuff. I particularly love Exile, because it's a really complex kind of adventure game, platform adventure game, not a kind of like text-based adventure game. So many like little in world jokes and things to learn about as you go through. There's a whole story and a novel to go with it. Really fantastic game.
Yeah, my favorite game of that time period, actually probably a couple of years later, which had a whole story and a novel to go with it, was the Leather Goddesses of Phobos on the Zork Adventures.
Yep.
At least said about Leather that. Goddesses, the better.
And the scratch and sniff clue. With
the scratch and sniff clue card, yes. Yep. But that was highly more advanced. That was 1986. Right?
Yeah, it wasn't until we moved on to the 16-bit, I think, with the PC, the Leisure Suit Larry emerged, Michael. So
yeah. Leather Goddess. I think there was a version on the 16-bit on the Commodore 64. I mean, on the 8-bit Commodore 64, because it was the Zork Adventures, but Leisure Suit Larry is the one because it had all the cool graphics.
I don't know whether I've spoken about this since I've been on the show a few times in the last couple of years, but have I mentioned to you that one of my colleagues sent me his Commodore 64, and I'm now the proud owner of his original Commodore 64? So actually, yeah, the Commodore 64 is a better analog for the BBC Micro than the Spectrum almost. And I converted it into a USB keyboard for my Raspberry Pi, but it can 100% be switched back to running as a full Commodore 64.
I really wish his
challenge to me, sorry, Michael, just ahead, to close it out, his challenge to me was to make it tweet. And there are ways to make it tweet. You can get add-on boards from Tindy and other websites. But the quickest way for me was to convert it into a USB keyboard. It's the worst keyboard in the world.
Yes, it is. But I really wish I had not sold my Commodore 64 SX, which, if you remember that one, that was the 20-pound luggable laptop with a 5-inch color screen and a single 5 1/4 floppy. It rocked.
Oh. Never had a Commodore, guys, so I'll live vicariously, Andy, through you as you get the Commodore to tweet.
Well, I mean, if anybody does, we've done that already, but if anybody, I'll send the mic with the USB keyboard kit.
Cool.
For the Commodore 64, or should anybody want to hack their old C64, it's as I say, it's completely reversible. It is kind of a fun thing to. I remember one of my company's co-founders came by our office one time and just like looked at this thing on my desk and was like, "What is that?" And I remember when it arrived, one of my other much younger co-workers also said, "What is that?"
And it's, I had a mainframe.
Yes, but this is what I grew up on. So
yes.
Well, so more modern times. People, and actually, this is an Ian story too. Come to think of it, because he's written about this, might desire to play on a more modern arcade structure and system like Google Stadia. And while Ian's played with this a bit, I've not personally been on Stadia at all. But now that it's free, maybe it's something to try, huh? How about you guys? Have either of you been on Stadia and given this a shot?
And Andy, you've been one of the early adopters.
I'm a founder. Yes, I've got the original controller and the bundled 4K Chromecast it came with.
Nice.
I mean, you know, the 4K Chromecast in itself is a useful thing. The controller's fine. It works. I get a free game every month, I guess, as part of my my whatever it was, founder's subscription. It's not founder, it's premier. I can't remember what their terminology was.
And it's not free
was.
Since you're paying a subscription.
Well, no, they said that I get 2 free months. Hurrah. I don't know. I've not had... I don't spend the majority of my time there, partly because it hasn't been feature complete. It's been incredibly difficult to build your network of friends, which obviously is one of the fun things with playing games online or playing games in a community these days, sharing achievements, all those kind of things, playing games at work. I don't play Stadia at work. I've been fascinated by this. I said to my wife earlier, I'm excited. I said to her, which she was playing Switch in our back garden. But I said, you know what? I really wish xCloud, Microsoft's solution, would come to the iPad so that I, you know, when we want to share a television or living room space, I can play an Xbox game on my iPad while you're using Switch on the big screen. Yes, of course, you can play Switch remote mobile. But, you know, we shouldn't have to make one choice over the other, you know? And I think, again, Stadia has that promise, right? Stadia says, ultimately, you'll be able to use your Stadia controller with whatever device is handy to you, whether it's an Android or iOS or other. But, you know, they're as far as I can tell, they're a long way away from being there. I'm just reading the story to remind people that it boasts 38 games available to purchase. And I will point out that, you know, while they're AAA games, you're purchasing them at, you know, essentially you're committing yourself to playing them on Stadia, right? I mean, they're AAA prices.
It's a subscription plus and buy games. Yeah.
Right. And the subscription, you know, entitles you to some freebies like Xbox Games Pass might, but very few compared to those other platforms like PlayStation and Xbox's subscriptions. But then if you want the AAA games, you're still going to have to pay for those AAA games.
Yep.
I haven't found particular performance issues. I've just found it unfulfilling because I'm not earning achievements. I'm not sharing with my friends. I'm not keeping a real record. And I find the experience a little clunky. And on that subject, very, very quickly, I don't know, this is nowhere in our show plan, but for example, Microsoft released a Gears game called Gears Pop. So it's using the Funko Pop models. for iOS, cool. And I think it's probably on Android as well, but either way, I've been playing it on my iOS devices. It's, you know, it's kind of fun, but the point is I'm getting Xbox achievements and I actually do enjoy being able to, you know, run a gamer score and keep track of what I've been playing and have achievements. And, you know, and the fact that Microsoft have opened that platform up to say, you know what, you're going to be able to earn achievements in our gaming environment and share your activity with people from whatever device you're on over time, I get a sense that that's where they're going, is exciting to me.
Cool.
The digital footprints, kind of like Swarm in the gaming world, is of high value to you, Andy.
Yes. Yeah. So it's both life logging in a gaming context, because gaming is part of my life.
Right.
And I enjoy that. And I have a whole other story about how I lost my Nintendo Switch and recently discovered that on an aeroplane last year, and recently discovered that even though I'd, you know, logged various lost and found claims, I've tweeted a little bit about it if people want to look it up. But I discovered that my Nintendo account had been renamed, and somebody had obviously been enjoying the fact that I'd lost my Switch. But I don't want to go take this conversation and this show too sideways, because that gets boring.
Well, not
I would say we would probably get rid of our family friendly rating if we did.
Yeah, that could happen. Yeah, awesome. which we're jealously guarding and protecting.
Yes.
All right. So let's pivot from the hard games to the hard math. And Michael, this is one from, what was it, physics.org, yep. About a cryptographic challenge.
Now, so we've talked about this challenge many different times over the years, going all the way back to when I participated in the DES challenge, gosh, back in the 90s, right? Of, you know, hacking DES and doing distributed workloads to see, could you break these highly encrypted systems? And the hacks have gotten easier and easier, but the cryptography has gotten harder and harder and more complex. And so what this is actually breaking the, I think it was the, was 128? Yeah, so the 250, sorry, 250, RSA yes. 250 cryptographic challenge. So a little bit better than 128. So which, you know, that is really 125 decimal digits of two prime numbers. It only took 2,700 years of compute power, but they did it, which shows once again that you can't think about security of can it be hacked now, right? Yep. You have to think that one day your security will be hacked if you just use one level of encryption or one factor of encryption. You know, that's why just having a password is not anywhere near as password and a second factor of, you know, maybe YubiKey or something like that. Or just having, you know, a really good facial recognition is one factor again. Right. And so these stories I find fascinating. It took them just a few months to do this because the previous challenge they hacked in 2019 at the 240 challenge. Mm-hmm. So a little over a year and down another 10 bits, which is, you know, that's pretty significant.
So is there an RSA 260 that's now kind of up for grabs?
That's the next target.
Yeah. So
I'm a bit surprised by the numbering, actually.
Yeah, you would figure it'd be 256.
Exactly. And then, so it was actually the one we're talking about, I believe. No, wait, it is to RSA 250, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just skipping through this.
And that's why, you know, the current standard is 2048, crazy. Right? 2048, right. One of those magic numbers, yeah. Right? But it used to be 256 not too long ago.
Well, I mean, there's a whole conversation about TLS and web security and how companies like Google and Microsoft are pushing out, for reasons of the current situation, some of their withdrawal of support for some of those encryption standards, withdrawal of support for the older ones.
Right.
Because there isn't time, or the view that some websites may be caught, you know, on the back foot. Should, you know, browsers withdraw support for some of the less secure ones, even though it's the right thing to do in the long arc of things?
Yeah, the challenge there is the way the security protocols work is they fall down. They back down the encryption. So, yeah, you could say, I'm a TLS, you know, 2.0, but my site also supports, you know, 1.1. And if somebody tries to get with 2.0 and fails, they can drop down to a hackable version. And that's why it's important to just flush them, get them out of the system.
Exactly.
Well, we are just about out of time, Michael. I know you found a couple other interesting things here.
Yeah, we're going to touch on those, and then we're going to have to get going. So one article that came across my feeds for this week was, what are the things that are in a little bit shorter supply? What are people, you know, really jonesing for these days? So toilet Andy, you were talking about, yeah, there's that, but you know, Andy, you've been, you know, eager to get on with some of your construction projects and compute projects and such. Apparently, one of the impacts for the coronavirus has been that people are really having jigsaw puzzles in hot demand, that that those have been flying off, so to speak, the virtual shelves, and people are spending time with their families as they are socially distancing them from others to work on their jigsaw puzzles. And I have to admit, I saw one of my own jigsaw puzzles in one of our closets recently. It's like, man, this would be kind of fun to go do. And it's satisfying to get that those last pieces in there. So I thought that was an interesting, interesting article. And in the article is also focused on a company called Ravensburger, which is a German manufacturer of said puzzles. And I've had puzzles from them for years and years and years.
I like the video where they actually show how they make them. That was really, really cool. It's,
I mean, Ravensburger is a hugely popular and well-known puzzle maker. But I'd also point out that, you know, this same challenge is applying to game, you know, board game, tabletop game makers. You know, a lot of these things are enjoying a long overdue, in my opinion, resurgence. And of course, there are online services as well coming along. I was reading about one of them today to enable you to play some of those board games. And I think it referred to quote unquote modern board games, i.e. everything after sort of 1990, the kind of the, as it's called, the Euro games kind of revival, with a lot of kind of new games that have sprung up with different rule sets and you know, themes and so on. We have an excellent range of games at home, which I'm very pleased about, but I wanted to refresh it because I, you know, figured that we might be at home a little bit longer, we currently have a long weekend, and unfortunately the two I ordered haven't arrived for this weekend. But I think jigsaw puzzles, Michael, you referred to something I've been doing. I finally got around to building the Lego mosaic of myself that I picked up in the Leicester Square in London flagship Lego store, or I think on its opening week back in 2013 or 14. No, 16, 2016. So it's not that old, but it's still nearly 4 years old.
Pretty old if you're a toddler.
And it's a puzzle.
I spent 3 hours placing one by one tiles on a very large base plate. And I'm now the proud owner. I've always been the owner, but I'm now the proud owner of a made up Lego pixel version of myself, which is quite fun.
Oh yeah, that's super cool. And I remember when you first got it, I saw the tweets about it. You know, staying on the Lego theme for a second before we close out, there was a tweet that came in from minifigs.me, and I think you switched me on to them, Andy, some time ago.
Carolina at minifigs.me is wonderful. They've got such a great service. They typically ship to me when I've ordered minifigs. Custom ones. They've typically shipped them in a little customized matchbox.
How cool!
And it's really cute. And they really love their subject. They really love the topic and what they do. Sorry, Michael, you should continue with what this particular story is about, because if you haven't come across them, minifigs.me, go check them out.
Yeah, you absolutely should. And the competition here is one that's easy to do from home, which is design a minifig. And they're having a contest here to focus on essential workers. And the ones that they have right now for this week are delivery drivers and postal workers, who obviously, if you are sequestered at home, you kind of rely on those people in a huge way. So I thought this was lovely. And I was excited about seeing that, too.
Very cool.
Really quick on that same subject, I am done, I promise. I walked to my local corner store today just to stock up on some supplies, and we've had, and I think you all have had in different places in the US, public shows of affection for those people, and particularly care workers in your communities. So we've been doing that in the UK on Thursday evenings, and people have been applauding our health services. But I found just on, you know, a 2-minute walk to the local store that clearly some local children had drawn on one of the local, on the driveways to their block of flats, a colorful tribute to say thank you to our National Health Service heroes. Mm-hmm. And there's also been, I believe there may have been around the world, the children drawing and pasting rainbows in windows and encouraging people to stay at home and stay safe. And, you know, it's those little things that made me smile today, I must admit.
Very cool.
Yeah, they do that in our neighborhood as well, Andy. It's really a global thing, and it's nice to see that. So Michael, take us home with the last piece. Is, you know, we're thinking about warm and cuddly things. You found this one nice one about it.
Yeah,
cat.
And this was that, you know, to say things that make me smile, to echo Andy's sentiment today. So this is an actually interesting article, and you have to watch the video that's attached. About 5 minutes long. It's a Twitch streamer, and as he's doing his stream, his cat opens the door to his room, comes in, and then wreaks havoc on the stream. and it's a beautiful orange tabby. We used to have an orange tabby, and he's about the same size. So that was an added bonus for me. But I just think of all the, you know, all the various different online meetings that are happening nowadays with the current situation. And this is something that you can think of that actually will make you smile during one of those meetings. If the cat would just come in and like ruin it. It was hilarious. I really enjoyed it. Highly recommended. And the griefers in the stream aren't really griefing. They're enjoying it too. And it's almost all positive, every bit of it. So enjoy.
Super. Well, we definitely will. Well, thanks to all of our listeners again for tuning in for this show. A little bit of an extended one, but we had some good things that we wanted to share with you. And we're excited to have you share a few things with us, too. So you know how to find us. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. Drop us a line. Share some of the interesting stories that you're seeing, too. And we'll begin to bring them up again when we're right back here next week. Same bad time, same bad channel. Well, it's whatever bat time and channel you do.
Which is the same one. It's the same one that you want to use, right? Anytime.
Yeah. It works for you.
Yes.
You have free will.
We'll see you next week. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.